real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
I'm glad to have you tuned in today. Hope you've had a wonderful holiday season so far. I'm Neil Stavem, Ted Ross at the controls, and we're winding down the year, Ted.
2017, pretty much almost in the books, a couple
it
more
is.
Days.
Yeah. And by the way, I just want to say thank you for considering Faith Radio and your year-end giving. Your gift postmarked here by the 31st, of course, will make a difference on your tax implications, if that's something that you're affected by.
Yeah, take advantage of that. Yeah. And we're blessed by those gifts, of course, as well in any denomination. Thank you for doing your part to keep us going here at Faith Radio.
You know, if you're looking ahead to the new year, maybe you want to join the prayer team, something by way of a New Year's resolution. That's something you can sign up for online. Go to myfaithradio.com and just click on prayer team and become a part of our family that prays for us regularly.
That's a good idea.
Well, speaking of ideas, we often talk here on Connecting Faith that ideas have consequences, and bad ideas have bad consequences, maybe even deadly, and that'll be our discussion today.
That's a good idea to listen, then.
We're going to talk about some bad ideas today and the dreadful consequences of bad arguments, you'll put it that way. You know, one of the interesting, maybe distinguishing characteristics of the so-called new atheism is its moral certitude. You've heard that, you know, the late Christopher Hitchens, Richard Dawkins, others. They've all declared that atheism has finally and convincingly won the war against Christian theism. But maybe just because they're loud doesn't mean they're right.
That's right, yeah.
My guest grandmother used to say this, empty vessels make the most noise. I think that's actually,
that's true.
We may find that is true. And here's something from historian N.T. Wright, who said, "It may be time to be skeptical about skepticism itself."
Yeah,
so we're going to address the skeptics today, the atheist, and the believer in confirming, I think, our faith. We're looking forward to a good conversation about a book that came out not too long ago called The Atheist Who Didn't Exist, or Other Dreadful Consequences of Bad Arguments. And there's a lot of great chapters in this book, like The Santa Delusion, Humpty Dumpty and the Vegan, The Peculiar Case of the Postmodern Penguin. And so,
sounds like a nightmare.
Well,
our
guest has had a few of those too, I think. But we're looking forward to talking today with Dr. Andy Bannister. He's a popular speaker, author, and broadcaster. Speaks and teaches regularly throughout Canada, the U.S., Europe, and the wider world, addressing audiences of all faiths or none on issues relating to faith, culture, politics, and society, philosophy, belief, and more. And he spends a good deal of his time working with Ravi Zacharias International Ministries, but also is working in his home in Scotland now to help bring about apologetics to the area where he's working. In fact, he has a doctorate in Islamic studies, so interesting background. And of course, he's got an accent, too, which is the main reason that we want Andy to come on the show.
Right.
So, Andy, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Great to be with you, and I have no idea what accent you are possibly talking about.
It'll go well the rest of the hour. I think we should mention that Andy is connecting with us from Scotland via Skype, and we're going to talk about the atheist who didn't exist. And you point out, as the subtitle suggests, that dreadful consequences of bad arguments, that, you know, bad arguments can be disseminated pretty widely and quickly. And I'm just wondering, is that because that the public's not really discerning to know enough that they're flawed?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's one of the issues. I also think we live in an age of social media, and so ideas can take root much more quickly. And also, at the same time, I think, you know, all credit to them, the so-called new atheists, people like Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris on your side of the Atlantic, Daniel Dennett and others, have done a magnificent job, I think, advocating for atheism. They're funny, they're clever. They play the media very, very well. And they've definitely succeeded, I think, putting atheism kind of out there. But as you hinted at in the introduction, I think what led me to write the book was just looking at their arguments and thinking, look, for all of the clever presentation, I didn't think there was a lot of substance behind them. And I found it sort of increasingly frustrating that people weren't asking the questions that needed to be asked. And so The Atheist Who Didn't Exist was an attempt to really kind of use humor, I think, a little bit to respond to this. I'd seen lots of Christians write you know, sort of quite dry academic books responding to some of this atheism, but the problem is those books were boring and nobody was reading them. And so really my book was an attempt to try and write something that somebody might actually want to read, that you could even give to an atheist friend and say, look, you won't agree with everything that Andy says, but hopefully you'll enjoy yourself as you read the book.
And if for no other reason than just the footnotes probably are a lot of fun. But.
Well, I like to think it is the first book where you want to go back a second time and read the footnotes. I like to think they are definitely worth reading. In fact, I think it makes the book worth twice the cover price. So if people buy this book and enjoy the footnotes, they can feel free to, you know, put $10 in the post and mail and send it across.
Sure. Well, we're all about your advancing your retirement account as much as we can, I think. But
incredibly generous of you. Thank you.
It's a full service show here on Connecting Faith. The names you mentioned, like Dawkins and Harris and others, I mean, they seem pretty, you know, sophisticated and sure themselves, but a lot of the arguments, it seems like, were kind of sound bites and maybe simplistic. Are they aware that, you know, sound bites aren't going to hold today, or do they just say weak point, pound pulpit here?
You know, I think that's a great question, and I think I always want to be sort of fair to both sides. I mean, Christians are not immune from soundbites too. I sort of grew up in a culture where, you know, Christians were, you know, one of my contemporaries were fond of slapping Christian soundbites on T-shirts and bumper stickers and so forth. And I think that can quite hardly be challenged on in our side of things. But I think behind the atheist side, what I found intriguing was behind the soundbites among our atheist friends, I don't think there was any substance. You know, if somebody accuses a Christian of a soundbite argument, I think hopefully there's the ability to go, look, okay, yes, guilty as charged, but look, here is something more substantive. What I wasn't seeing on the atheist side was that substance. But the thing is, I think soundbites work very well in the social media age again. They tweet well, they're very clever, they're funny. But of course, we always, whenever you hear a soundbite, it's always worth asking the question, is that soundbite true?
Did this come, your interest? Was it something developed over a long time? I mean, because you did the doctorate studies in Islamic studies, so that doesn't seem like necessarily something that would be talking about the, you know, new atheists. How did that sort of interest come?
Yeah, I mean, I've really for the last kind of 20 years or so had a kind of twin track. I mean, academically, it was Islam was where I was interested. Growing out a lot of conversations I had with Muslim friends in London, where I used to live, and eventually a lot of those conversations about faith led me to do a PhD in Islam so I could understand my Muslim friends better and hopefully share Christ more effectively with them. But at the same time, I've always kept an interest in philosophy, had taught at the university kind of level. So I was always interested in atheism. But what was interesting, it wasn't really until 2006 that atheism became mainstream. That was the year that the new atheism first kind of hit the airwaves. And in fact, the term the new atheism was first coined in 2006 by a journalist at Wired magazine. And that was, I think that was the year that Richard Dawkins' book, The God Delusion, came out. I remember sort of thinking, now this is interesting. You know, for years, I'd always associated atheism with the slightly geeky person sitting in the corner of the party with no friends. And, you know, it wasn't really mainstream, wasn't really getting anywhere. And what Dawkins and Dennett and others managed to do was kind of popularize it. And I suddenly found myself thinking, okay, somebody needs to respond to this. Because, as I say, lots of Christians I found were writing academically and responding, but not really getting traction. And I think what the new atheists did was work out how to get traction for their arguments. And so, as I sort of thought about how to do this, I came across a comment that the Christian writer C.S. Lewis once made. I'm sure many of your listeners, you know and love Lewis. And on one occasion, he was talking about why he, after writing lots of works of philosophy and theology, why he set out to write the Narnia books, his fiction. And he said, I'd noticed, he said, that often you can't get arguments past the front door of people's minds because those front doors, as it were, are guarded by watchful dragons. But he said, I wonder whether, you know, using fiction and story, we might tiptoe past those watchful dragons and kind of sneak truth in the side door. And I found myself thinking, you know, I can't write fiction like Lewis, but I have been told I'm quite funny. So maybe we could tickle the dragon under the nose. And while it's rolling on the floor laughing, we can charge in with truth through the front door.
You know, we're all in favor of that. I think, you know, tickling dragons is that does sound like, you know, better than the typical option, I guess. You know, one of the things that I was mentioning here before the show, I heard Alistair Begg commenting not too long ago about Romans 1 and 2, of course, where that, you know, spells out pretty clearly about how, you know, evidence for God is, you know, available. But he said, no one is born an atheist. Is this a choice because we don't want to believe, or or don't want to obey? I mean, what's the driving force behind it?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think there's three things going on as I've interacted with hundreds of atheists across the years and read, you know, a lot of the books. I mean, certainly for some atheists, absolutely. I think the atheism is really a moral issue going on. They don't want to bow the knee. They want to be autonomous. They want to be in charge of their own lives. And that's not me saying it. There are atheists who admit that. So in my book, in fact, I quote a very famous 20th century atheist called Aldous Huxley, who basically admitted, he said, you know, he wanted to live his life, particularly in terms of sexual freedom, a particular way. He figured out that, you know, Christianity didn't allow that. So the easiest way to deal with that was to dismiss Christianity and embrace atheism. So that's clearly a moral rebellion. But we also need to be careful. That doesn't cover every atheist. I meet many atheists who would say they're atheists because they've had a bad experience with Christianity. And I think we need to take that very seriously. That at times, the church has done real damage to people. People have had bad experiences of church where there should have been good ones. And I meet many atheists who, when you dig into their stories, because of something that was said, something that was done, they wrote the whole thing off because they had a bad experience with a particular group of Christians. And that's a whole different approach. There, I think that requires listening, it requires compassion, it requires us demonstrating that, okay, somebody may have done something horrific in the name of Christ, but that doesn't mean that Christianity is itself false. It means that Christians are, like everybody else, messed up, broken people. And then thirdly, I think you will meet atheists who do have genuine intellectual difficulties. There's an objection that they can't get past. Like a very common one that I run into is the problem of evil. I know many people who look, you know, at the kind of world that we live in with all that's going on right now, and have genuinely concluded for what they believe to be good reasons that they can't take belief in God seriously because of that problem. And in that case, I think it's our job to sit down carefully and explain to them why we think they're wrong, why we think there are good reasons to believe in God. And of course, you know, the Bible is thoroughly behind that. 1 Peter 3 verse 15, always be prepared to give a reason for the hope that you have, and do this with gentleness and respect. So I think those are three very different reasons. And so I always stress to people, if you've got atheist friends, colleagues, neighbours, classmates, try and start by finding out, why is the person you're talking to an atheist? Ask them. Just ask them the question, why are you an atheist? Why don't you believe in God? And often they'll outright tell you, and then you can determine the approach you want to take based on that.
We'll spend some time asking some questions and getting some answers, and you're welcome to join the conversation with Andy Bannister. Dr. Bannister, popular author, speaker, and broadcaster, and he's written a book we're referencing today called The Atheist Who Didn't Exist, or The Dreadful Consequences of Bad Arguments. Andy spends part of his time working with Ravi Zacharias International Ministries. He also has a ministry in Scotland that is working and centering in the area of apologetics. And he's joining us today via Skype, and we'll continue in just a moment with more here on Connecting Faith. Romans 1 and 2 remind us that God has made himself known to us. But there are many today who don't see God in the picture at all. We're talking about the atheist, and particularly referencing a book from Dr. Andy Bannister called The Atheist Who Didn't Exist, or The Dreadful Consequences of Bad Arguments. And it's an enjoyable read to address, you know, some of the underlying issues behind an atheist's argument. Andy spends a good deal of his time with Ravi Zacharias Ministries and speaking and writing and teaching on apologetics as a ministry in Scotland, where we're talking to him today. But Andy, let's talk about, you know, the idea of maybe a disbelief in God. Is, if we don't believe in God, is that sufficient to not have to defend the idea? Is the absence of belief exempt from defense?
The simple answer is no, it isn't. And it's interesting that it's something you'll hear some atheists claim quite a lot. They'll claim there's no burden of proof, that it's the burden of proof is on Christians, and that an atheist is somebody who simply lacks a belief. They merely lack a belief in God. And if you lack something, if that's all that atheism is, just a lack of belief, then you don't have to defend it. And the problem is that that fails on all kinds of levels. It fails, I mean, at the start out, right out, it fails philosophically, because philosophically, if you make a statement, make a proposition, you have to defend it. And the proposition, there is no God, requires defending in the same way as the belief there is a God. But the other problem, I think, the idea that atheism is merely the lack of a belief runs into is it fails on all kinds of sort of unintended levels as well for the atheist. I mean, if atheism is merely the lack of belief in God, then, you know, small rocks and, you know, rubber chickens and Richard Dawkins' left foot, they all lack a belief in God, so they are presumably atheists. It seems a little bit odd to say a rock is an atheist or a rubber chicken is an atheist. And then furthermore, of course, the other thing, one of the things about beliefs that is notable about them is beliefs tend to be sort of identity forming for people. So as Christians, we call ourselves Christians. We gather together as Christian communities. Being a Christian shapes my identity, as it probably does for you and for many listening to this. But what about atheism? If atheism is merely the lack of belief in God, then it should have no effect at all. But that's not the case. I regularly run across people who self-define as atheists, who change their social media profile to amusing little pictures of the flying spaghetti monster and other kind of atheist logos. I regularly run across atheist clubs and societies on university campuses. You know, high-profile atheists like Richard Dawkins write books about atheism. And the more you look at this, the more you are forced to the conclusion atheism is a belief. It may not be a religion, although even that we could argue, but it's certainly a belief. And because it's a belief, it needs to be defended. And all I'm saying to my atheist friends, I'm not playing fast and loose here, simply saying, look, all of us have things that we believe deeply. Christians do, Muslims do, Hindus do, Buddhists do, and atheists do as well. And your most deeply held beliefs about life and reality and the universe and so all these kind of things and God and so forth, we need to come to the table, admit what our beliefs are, and then be prepared to defend them and explain the reasons why we believe them to be true.
One of the things you address, you talk about transferring an argument to a different setting to test its worth. What does that look like?
Well, one of the things I notice that sometimes when we engage with these arguments, either what our atheist friends are saying or Christian responses, if you're not if you're not particularly sort of into sort of philosophy and theology, sometimes this can seem to get a sort of bit complex quite quickly. And transferring something into a more popular setting or a very different setting can often help you see the problem in the argument. So let me give you a very good example. The idea that atheism is merely the absence of a belief. In the book, I use an illustration to explain what's wrong with that argument. Many of us may look at that claim and go, well, what's wrong with it? Well, one way to illustrate what's wrong with it is like this. Imagine that you were sitting in a coffee shop, you were sitting in your local Dunkin' Donuts, or if you're richer than I, you're in Starbucks, or Six Bucks, we used to call it in Toronto. and you're sitting there having coffee with a friend, and suddenly your friend announces that they don't believe in Sweden. They actually don't believe that the country of Sweden exists. And you kind of splutter over your latte and you say, well, That's incredible. What's your evidence for this? And they look at you and go, ah, no. You see, I just lack a belief in Sweden. I don't have to defend that. It's you who believe in Sweden that needs to defend your belief. But me, who doesn't believe in this particular small Scandinavian legendary country, I have no burden of proof. Now, we would instantly see the problem there. Anybody looking at it can see, well, you know what? There's something obviously wrong with that idea. And that little illustration, I think, helps us see what a fallacious idea it is to say that not believing in something doesn't require a defense.
You know, it does seem that it's easy to maybe dismiss some arguments as not likely, but then others get affirmed. And I guess, you know, we all are maybe subject to that, where we will dismiss some but affirm others. Say a bit more about that.
Well, I think a number of things I'd say around there. I think one of the things we need to be careful of, and as Christians, we need to be conscious of this as well. You know, it's very, very easy merely to simply to hold on to and embrace and adopt arguments that support your own position and treat them more fairly than those that are against it. So as Christians, you know, a natural disposition is anything that appears to support our Christian faith, we grab hold of, and anything that makes, you know, atheists or Muslims or Hindus look bad, however bad that argument is, we kind of grab hold of it and go, hooray, isn't it wonderful? And I think it's right for people to call us out when we do that. But we can certainly call our atheist friends out when they do the same thing. It's not merely Christians who are fond of that. And I'm always going to be very careful and very fair and say that there are bad Christian arguments and there are bad atheist arguments. There are also really good Christian arguments. For example, the evidence for the resurrection is a fantastic argument. There's incredibly strong evidence for the resurrection. So as Christians, we should talk about that. I haven't yet personally seen a very, very strong argument for atheism. I've seen better arguments than others, but I haven't yet seen anything that's as powerful as the evidence for Christianity. And ultimately, that brings me back, and I always want to say this to people when I'm dialoguing and engaging with them, look, there's only one reason to believe in Christianity, and that's if it's true. If it's true, you should believe it. If it's not true, then you should abandon it tomorrow. That's what matters ultimately. The reason I'm a Christian is not because I was raised that way or because it's comfortable or easy for me or any of those things. The reason I'm a Christian is because I believe it to be true. The reason I'm not an atheist is I believe atheism to be false.
You, in the book, The Atheist Who Did Exist, you suggest there are some similarities between the new atheism and Islam. And I know you've done a lot of research on Islam. Explain a bit more about that.
Yeah, I mean, as I say, over the years, I've been sort of studying Islam now for sort of 15 to 20 years. And one of the things I've noticed, and again, we've got to be careful not to tar everybody with the same brush, but certainly for many Muslims I meet, they believe Islam to be self-evidently true. They're not really willing to ask critical questions about their faith. And really, they're not really willing to treat any position other than Islam kind of seriously. And so when I engage with Muslims, for example, I see a lot of caricatures of Christian faith represented. And as I began studying the new atheism, it struck me just how bizarre it is, in a sense, that all of those three statements hold true for the new atheism. Now, again, not for every atheist. I know some very generous atheist writers and thinkers who would take Christian arguments very seriously. But certainly the new atheism behaves in the same way. You know, Richard Dawkins thinks that anyone who's not an atheist is an idiot. You know, he calls us dyed-in-the-wool faith heads. That's very similar to the way that some Muslims talk about non-Islamic faith. Most atheists I know have never actually looked into the evidence against atheism. They spend most of their time just sort of dealing in their arguments against Christianity, and so it goes. And so I think there are a number of similarities, and I think that when you push into that, well, the common connection is fundamentalism. And fundamentalism is a word that's thrown around a lot in our culture, and sometimes it can just be an insult. Sometimes it's just used to mean somebody who believes something more passionately than I do. But I think a better description of fundamentalism is somebody who believes something, who has never even looked at the alternatives, who's got their fingers in their ears, refusing to even listen to people who think differently, who wants to demonize those who think differently, and so on and so forth. And that's not biblical Christianity. I'm always very clear to Christian audiences and to atheist audiences too. The Bible encourages Christians to think about the evidence for our faith. Christianity is an evidence-based faith. You know, in the book of Acts, that first kind of evangelistic sermon that's preached in Acts chapter 2, a few days after the resurrection, Peter doesn't just say to the gathered crowds on the day of Pentecost there, doesn't just say, hey, believe because you should believe because you believe. He talks about evidence. He points to the empty tomb. He talks about the resurrection done in the full light of history. He gives reasons why you can believe the Christian faith to be true. And the Bible commends faith, but it doesn't commend blind faith. And I think blind faith is very dangerous. So I see blind faith among some of my Muslim friends, and I certainly see it in the new atheism.
We're going to continue the discussion in a moment. We'll circle back, talk a little bit about the fundamentalism. There's this, suggestion that the wars and evil, all that is because of religious extremism, whether it's on Islam or Christianity side. We'll get Andy Bannister's reflections on that. He's a speaker, author, broadcaster. And he enjoys, in his free time, mountaineering, juggling, and cats, although not simultaneously, as he says, which I think is important. Talking about the book, The Atheist Who Didn't Exist, and you can join the conversation at 877-933-2484. I hope that our conversation, Opening Eyes, as well, that Andy Bannister's book certainly will help you as you deal with those that maybe claim atheism. And you can think a little bit deeper about some of the popular claims that they have. The Atheist Who Didn't Exist, or The Dreadful Consequences of Bad Arguments. As we say often, ideas have consequences, bad ideas have bad consequences. Dr. Andy Bannister is a speaker, author, and broadcaster, and there's a lot of speaking and teaching through Ravi Zacharias International Ministries in Canada, and U.S., Europe, and around the world, and has a ministry in Scotland. We're talking to him today via Skype. And we're talking before the break a little bit about, Islam and the fundamentalism. And, it seems like there's an argument that sometimes is offered that religion is the cause of wars and evil, and that Christianity in its extreme, as bad as Islam is in its extreme. What's your perception on that issue?
It's a great question, and one I think that's being asked, you know, ever more in the kind of world we live in when we open the newspapers every day and see examples of religiously inspired violence. I want to say a couple of things. Firstly, I want to address the broader issue that's sometimes behind there, this idea that religion poisons everything. In fact, that was Christopher Hitchens, the famous atheist, who said that line. And I know many atheists who would claim that, you know, religion has been cause of, you know, most of the wars and violence in history. And I think there it's very important to push back and say that simply isn't true. I mean, it's just demonstrably false. There was a massive book came out a few years ago called the Encyclopedia of Wars. And in three huge volumes, the editors of that book have studied 1,763 wars that have took place between 8,000 BC and 2003. And it's interesting, of those 1,763 wars, they only categorize 123 as religious. That's 7% of all wars in 10,000 years of history. So I always jokingly say to my atheist friends, look, if religious people are the ones trying to cause all the wars in history, we're slackers in this regard. We've got quite a lot of work to do. Most wars in history are actually caused by government, particularly in more modern warfare. And if we're going to ban anything, we should ban government. Now, what about Islam, though? So, okay, one of the issues here, of course, is that right now we're dealing with a resurgent Islam with a fundamentalist Islamist streak within that. And thankfully, it's a minority of Muslims, but it's still a significant minority. And I think one of the things here we need to push into is to say, look, you know, religion is in some ways a very unhelpful term. You know, it hasn't often occurred to my atheist friends that most people don't think of themselves as religious. I don't know about you. I don't get up in the morning and think, hey, I am a religious person. I have a religion. I think of myself as a Christian. I have faith in Christ. And the problem with using religion as this kind of bucket category, it jams things together. And it assumes that, well, Islam is just basically the same as Christianity, but with beards and burqas. And I think what we need to encourage people to do is to actually look into the teachings and the beliefs of the different religions. And they are vastly, vastly different. There are huge differences between Christianity and Islam, just as there are huge differences between Islam and Buddhism. And in fact, Buddhism is an interesting example because it takes Christianity off the table for a moment. And it's very, very interesting to look what happened when the Chinese moted into Tibet a few years ago and, you know, brutalized that largely Buddhist country. We didn't see Buddhist monks en masse blowing themselves up in public, committing, you know, huge terrorist atrocities. And that wasn't their response to, you know, demonstrably violent provocation, which tells you there's a profound difference between Buddhism and, say, a religion like Islam that would probably responded quite differently. And there are huge differences, again, between Islam and Christianity. And the biggest difference between Islam and Christianity lies in the founder. Because in Muhammad, we have a man who was a warlord and a warrior, a charismatic military leader. That's not to insult him, it's to put him in his place in history. He was a spectacularly successful military leader, laid the seeds for a great empire. And on the other hand, you have Jesus Christ, one to whom violence was done. And thus, when you see a Christian behaving violently, you need to take them to Jesus Christ and say, how can you call yourself a Christian when you're following somebody who said, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you? On the other hand, when you meet a Muslim who's inclined towards behaving violently, I want to get them as far away from the historical Muhammad as I possibly can, because he was a man who did use violence. And the best way to expose that, as I say, is go back to the founders. Rather than talk about Islam and Christianity in the abstract, let's talk about Jesus. Let's talk about Muhammad. Let's stand their two lives side by side and ask ourselves, given the fractured, divided 21st century world we live in, which offers the greatest model for bringing people together and helping us find ways to unite despite our differences? I don't think Muhammad is the best example. I do think Jesus is.
There's one of the other frequent arguments, I guess, or props for atheism is the science. In fact, the science covers a lot of things. It's become kind of a religious force and holds the answers to everything, or at least so it says. So if science can't explain it, it can't be real. Talk about science.
Well, of course, you're absolutely right that I think science has become kind of almost like a de facto religion for some. And this idea that if science can't explain it, it isn't true. Of course, the problem with the statement that only the things that science explains are true is that statement itself can't be explained using science. You have at that point moved from science into philosophy and quite literally chainsawed off the branch that you were sitting on. And what I always want to say to people is, look, science is fantastic. Science is probably one of the best tools that human beings have ever invented. And it does a lot of things very well, but like all tools, it does some things well and some things badly, in the same way that a hammer is a marvelous tool for putting in nails. If you're putting a set of shelves up, if you want to do brain surgery, a hammer is probably not quite what you want, unless you're operating on certain politicians. And it's the same with science. I think science does certain things very, very well. And in particular, science tells us how stuff works. When you've got a world full of stuff, atoms and particles and molecules and so forth, science does a pretty spectacular job explaining how that works. But one of the things that science can't answer is how we have a world of stuff in the first place. And one of the things I find worrying is when people start trying to use science to explain why it is we have a universe in the first place. And science simply can't answer that question. It wasn't designed to do so. At that point, you move even beyond science. In fact, I think the very fact that we have a universe with atoms and particles, we have a universe with where the laws of physics, laws of science exist, where mathematics so beautifully describes our universe through the complex and intricate laws of physics. The fact we have that reality, to me, is one of the greatest pointers to God. And in fact, science, I don't think, is antithetical to God. Science is a great big signpost pointing in the God direction, saying, hey, there's something interesting here. Go take a look at it.
You quote Mark Twain, which is, he had a great way of saying things. But he says, faith is believing what you know ain't so. And I'm just wondering, you address the new atheist suggests that, well, if we're going to believe in God, it's equivalent to the tooth fairy or Santa Claus. Is it the issue of faith and reason that so many choose to be skeptical because they don't want to dive in the faith category?
Well, I think there is a degree of that. I think some atheists, have mistakenly assumed exactly faith means believing things which there is no evidence, or as Richard Dawkins put it, faith is believing things in the teeth of the evidence. And nobody really wants to believe things for which there is no evidence. We all want to be reasonable human beings, and so religion's written off. But what I say there is to go that the problem with that is that represents an utter misunderstanding of what the word faith means. But nowhere does the Bible say that faith means believing things for which there is no evidence. The Bible describes faith as a gift, but it's not the gift of stupidity. And in fact, the word faith is interesting. You see, the word faith, the English word faith, comes from a Latin word, fides, that means to trust. To have faith means to put your trust in something. It means to look at the facts, to look at the evidence, but there comes a point where you have to move beyond the evidence and actually put your trust in something. The analogy I sometimes use, if you're out walking in the wilderness in the backcountry somewhere, and you suddenly an angry bear leaps out on you and chases you, and you as you're running along, you're coming towards the edge of a cliff, and you realize you've got no choice but to jump or face the bear. And as you look over the cliff edge, you see three different trees growing out of the cliff edge. And very quickly, because you've got a background in botany, you assess that which types of plant those trees are. You did a bit of engineering at high school, so you're able to sort of assess the various forces those trees could hold. You could know every possible fact about those three trees, but ultimately, you're going to have to put your faith in one of them if you're going to jump off the cliff and survive being eaten alive by the bear. Facts don't help you. Facts only get you so far. Or to use another more personal example, I've been married to my wife for 19 years. It was our 19th wedding anniversary yesterday. And, 19 years ago, 19 and a half years ago, when I asked her to marry me, I had all kind of facts I knew about my wife. I knew her, how she looked. I knew what she made her laugh. I knew her favorite food, all kinds of facts. But at the moment I asked her to marry me, I was then putting my trust in her. I was moving from beliefs about to belief in. And that's what the Bible does. The Bible says, here's the evidence for who God is and all the things he's done in history. But the Bible says belief is not enough. In fact, the Bible doesn't want us to just believe in God. If you recall, the Bible says even the demons believe in God and shudder. What the Bible wants us to do is to look at who God is supremely, who he has revealed himself to be in and through Jesus. And then the question is not will you believe, the question is will you trust? And that's what faith means. It's not blind faith. It's looking at the evidence and saying, okay, now am I willing to make this personal and actually take an action based upon the facts that are in front of me?
Well, happy anniversary to you. Before our time is gone, let's talk about maybe some of the questions that we should be asking first before trying to give answers. I mean, we were told First Peter, always be ready to give an answer. But are there some questions we could be asking?
Yeah, I think there are three questions actually you can use, and questions are important because Jesus used questions all the time. Read the Gospels sometime and see how often in his dialogues with people he used questions. He was asked a question, he'd respond with a question. And I'd love to actually leave people with that there are three questions that are really helpful to have in your back pocket as you engage with atheists and skeptics and folks who are not Christians. First question is, you can say to somebody, what do you mean by that? So when someone says something like, oh, I don't believe in God, there's no evidence. Rather than try and sort of leap in and provide evidence, start by saying, well, what do you mean by the word evidence? You know, what kind of evidence would be acceptable to you? What would you need to see for you to consider there was a God? So what do you mean by that? Look at what your friend has said and sort of deconstruct it a little bit. That's the first question. Second question is to say to somebody when they come out with a statement or an objection to the Christian faith, what's your evidence for that? So perhaps someone says to you, oh, I can't believe the Bible. It's a load of myths and legends and fairy tales. Why don't you just take that on the chin, look at them politely and smile and say, that's a really interesting perspective. Tell me, what's your evidence for that? How have you come to believe that? Because often our atheist friends just come out with a soundbite or a conclusion, but don't tell you their reasoning. And then lastly, the place I always want to try and take people in all of my conversations is to sort of push people into, what do you think about Jesus? Because ultimately, right, we're not going to argue someone into the kingdom of God. The Christian faith isn't about arguments primarily. It's about somebody seeing and grasping who Jesus is and then being forced to make that decision to answer that question that he asks every single one of us. Who do you say that I am? And whether it's Muslim friends or Buddhist friends or atheist friends, I'm always keen to be thinking about how do I get them to actually take a fresh look at Jesus? And so a question like, who do you think that Jesus was? What do you think he meant when he said, you know, whatever? Anything I can do to get somebody actually looking at the person of Jesus, because he is the center of Christian faith. And that also reminds me that it's not about my clever arguments and my clever words. Our job as Christians is to introduce people to Jesus and then get the heck out of the way and let him take it from there.
Indeed. Well, we've had a good primer today to help us think through some of the issues and ask some of the questions. And I want to recommend the book, The Atheist Who Didn't Exist, or The Dreadful Consequences of Bad Arguments, written by Dr. Andy Bannister. Andy, if people want to find out maybe more about your work in ministry, can they go connect through Ravi, or what do you recommend?
There are two places they can go. I mean, I wear two hats. I'm with Ravi a third of my time, so they can go to rzim.org, and they'll find Ravi's organization. And the organization I'm with in the UK is called SOLAS, and that's the Scottish word, the Gaelic word for sunshine, for sunrise. And they can go to SOLAS, S-O-L-A-S. -CPC, that's the Center for Public Christianity .org, solas-cpc.org. And then they can find me on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all the kind of usual places. And in terms of the book, actually, we have a website, theatheistwhodidn'texist.com, theatheistwhodidn'exist.com, and you can download a free chapter and have a read and check out more about the book there.
Good to visit with you today, Andy. Thank you for your good work, and blesses you as you continue to minister and provide some good questions and some great answers.
Well, fantastic. It's been a great conversation. Thank you so much.
We'll keep the focus on apologetics as Connecting Faith continues. Coming up in a moment, another visit with Rick Matson. Listening to Connecting Faith, and it's time once again to connect with Rick Matson. Rick is an apologetics specialist for InterVarsity Christian Fellowship, and we get together periodically to talk about how to more effectively share our faith with the friends, neighbors, co-workers, and particularly those who may be skeptical, and I guess that's probably the majority of people. In fact, Rick has written a book called Faith is Like Skydiving and Other Memorable Images for Dialogue with Seekers and Skeptics, and we do want it to be a dialogue. We just sometimes have a hard time knowing how to get started. Rick serves Hamline University in Minnesota as a staffer with InterVarsity Christian Fellowship, but he also travels around the country speaking in the college and university campuses. And Rick, this is a topic I want to find out a little bit more about, because you recommend something called a prayer map. So tell us about that.
A prayer map is a tool that we use on college campuses with our InterVarsity students who want to do outreach. They don't always know who to reach out to, however. Sometimes God has put more people in our lives than we first recognize. Mm. We only see what's right in front of us. And a prayer map is a way for us to, sometimes it's called a network map. You, on a piece of paper, figure out all the different networks that God has placed in your life. And he has put you there for a strategic reason, and that is to be his representative. So if I could just kind of explain yeah. how this goes. First thing you do is you put a small circle, that being yourself, in the middle of a piece of paper, and that's the hub. The circle in the middle, that's you, that's the hub. And then you draw spokes out from the circle. And there might be 5, 8, 10 different spokes all around the sheet of paper from the middle out toward the edges. And each one of those then represents a network. So once you get out to the end of a spoke, maybe toward the top of the piece of paper or the sides or the bottom, then you draw another circle and you start listing all the people in that particular network. So it might be your place of employment at your job. And you might list 5 or 10 people there. And now you're starting to think, whoa, I hadn't thought of that person. Yeah, I guess God did put me in their life. Maybe this was arranged. Maybe my life isn't just a big accident. You follow another spoke out, draw a circle around people in your neighborhood, and you list all the people in your neighborhood. And this might take more than one sheet of paper, or write small. And then you think, wow, yeah, I did have that conversation with Julie the other day. It never dawned on me that God maybe arranged for that encounter to happen. Another spoke could be your friends. Another one could be old friends from high school and college or school or whatever. Another one could be if you like to go to the gym. I like to play golf. People like to swim. They're in dance classes and so forth. List the people in there that God may have brought into your life. You have all these networks that you don't really realize, and when you see them on a piece of paper, it's an awakening experience. Like, whoa, I hadn't thought of that. Yeah. Well, then the next step is after you look through those names, then you start praying over them. And you just say, Lord, who do you want me to reach out to right now? Whose hearts are you preparing that you want me to have kind of the next step, take the next step with that person? So in some cases, take the next step means just going and having coffee or just talking over the backyard fence or going and doing a project together, maybe serving together someplace, raking leaves for somebody else and do it with a friend who's not a believer. Or in my case, okay, let's go have a round of golf together and enjoy time together on the golf course. Or maybe it's time to share the gospel with that person. We've had all these conversations, all these spiritual conversations in the weeks and months preceding, it's time to ask the person, has anyone ever shared a summary of the gospel message with you? And could I do that? So maybe it's time to do that. So as you pray through all the names, just ask the Lord to bring to mind the people that he especially wants you to focus on. And could I just do one more segment on this? Sorry, I'm doing all the talking here, Neil.
No, because I'm writing notes.
No, I want to be the host and interview you sometime. But I think the next step then, or what's integrated into these steps that I've been talking about, is to have this theology of witness that says this. I'm not the one who's bringing Jesus to them. Jesus is already there. He's already out there in those networks, drawing people to himself. He is working in their lives. My job is to be the detective, to discover, to discern what he's already doing and step into the process that's already occurring. I simply don't have the power to manufacture all of that spiritual change in another person, but I do have the ability to say yes to God. And isn't there that old saying, something about it's not your ability, it's your availability? I always like that saying because it means that I'm relying on God, not my own strength, my own cleverness, let's say. And hey, I'm trained. I'm an evangelist. But to rely on your training and cleverness and all of that, your own wisdom, that's not going to result in fruit and evangelism. But walking in and saying, oh, that's what God is doing. They have an interest in the arts. Let's go to the art gallery and talk about the worldview of the artist. And maybe there's some paintings there or some other art forms that have been done by Christians, and that might become a topic of conversation. That's what God is doing in that person's life, so I'm going to go there instead of forcing the conversation to someone else. And that's what takes spiritual discernment, takes prayer.
And I think, too, what an important step it is for us to realize that, you know, we're here where we are on purpose. We might be in a job that we don't really like, or, you know, a neighborhood we don't, you know, enjoy or whatever. But, I mean, the fact that we're here for a purpose, aren't we? And
right.
To actually start writing that out, we can suddenly see a little bigger picture.
Yeah, I'd encourage folks to go to Acts chapter 8 and watch how Philip is moved by God. It's very much on purpose. It's very intentional. It's very strategic on the part of the Lord. It's as if the Lord's right hand is with Philip and his left hand is with this eunuch, this person who's interested in God, this God-fearer. And God puts them together on the road. And I forget what road that is anyway. I haven't looked at the passage in a while. But I just remember that the Lord is intentionally putting
Joppa.
These...
I think it's Joppa. Joppa.
Okay.
Road to Joppa.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
The Lord is intentionally putting this encounter together. You know, the Lord could just go himself, could just send an angel, could just snap his fingers. But he uses human messengers, frail as we are, to communicate his truths about reality. I just find that astonishing. He's the senior partner. We're the junior partners. He's called us, but he's called us into work that he's already started. And I just find that very exciting and very much of a relief. The burden is off me to be this perfect evangelist, which I'm not.
I was thinking, too, just as you're describing the prayer map, that it is very likely that as we fill in some names, we may not know the names. We go, well, yeah, there's, okay, I guess I don't actually know more than two of my neighbors, but there's six of them around, or, you know, coworkers, I say hi, but other than his name is Bob, maybe, because it says it on a shirt, or, you know, so so probably the next step is to just start being a little more intentional.
Yeah, be more intentional. I write stuff down, too.
Okay.
You should see the file I have on you. But I go home and I just write things down because I have a lot of people in my life. I'm a pretty outgoing person. I know a ton of people, but I just cannot keep track of the details of their lives. So I know it sounds a little cold, maybe a little mechanical, but I just write things down. And before I'm going to go see someone, I might glance at that and think, oh, yeah, that's right. They're, one of their relatives is struggling with a health issue, and I agreed to pray for that. I have a little bit. Haven't done it in a while. Okay, I'm going to pray on the way over there, and I'm going to care for this person in a way that gets down into the particulars of their life. And one of those particulars is to know their name.
Is there a prayer that you keep coming back to maybe time and time again, just to get started and say, but Lord, use me, or should we be more specific?
Lord, what are you doing in this person's life? Lord, I'm an observer today. I'm going to go in and watch what you're doing, even when I'm talking, even when I'm acting, even when I'm golfing. No matter what it is, I'm also, a part of me is going to be an observer of this interaction, an observer of the Spirit. I'm going to be watching for divine moments. I'm going to be watching for teachability in this other person so that I can insert something that's from God. So prayers along those lines for myself, that I'm going to be a watchful a quality observer, but also prayer for the other person, that God would be working in their heart and their mind and their will, all three. When people come to faith, it really takes all three of those. And when the Lord is doing all of that, and I notice it and step into the process, that's where we see the fruit.
God's already at work. We can join him there if we become a bit more intentional. And getting some great insight today from Rick Matson. By the way, Rick speaks not only at college and university campuses, but churches as well. And he can provide some training perhaps for you or your Sunday school class on how to be more effective in engaging others in spiritual conversations. You can connect with him at rickmatsonoutreach.com. That's rickmatsonoutreach.com. And pick up a copy of his book, Faith is Like Skydiving, and Other Memorable Images for Dialogue with Seekers and Skeptics. Rick is an apologetics specialist with the University Christian Fellowship and is a regular guest with us here in Connecting Faith. Good to see you again, Rick.
Thanks, Neil.
Thanks for tuning in to Connecting Faith today. If you want to review what Rick had to say here today, you can listen to that conversation as well as our previous conversation with Andy Bannister about The Atheist Who Didn't Exist. Both those interviews posted on the Connecting Faith show page at MyFaithRadio.com. That's Connecting Faith at MyFaithRadio.com.